They felt Jackie had manipulated them and that they'd requested their names be taken out of the Rolling Stone article to no avail. It also emerged that Rolling Stone had agreed, at Jackie's request, not to contact any of her alleged attackers for their side of the story. A subsequent police investigation involving 70 people, including Jackie's friends, colleagues, and members of the Phi Kappa Psi fraternity, found no one to corroborate her story. By mid-2015, Rolling Stone's article had been retracted and removed from the site. The editor responsible for publishing the story had resigned, and the magazine was facing multiple lawsuits. Rolling Stone's humiliation came at the height of rape culture panic on college campuses, in which feminist activists convinced the media, as well as the White House, that college-aged women were being raped at levels comparable to war-torn, lawless countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo. The statistic they endlessly trot out is that 1 in 4 women will be sexually assaulted during their time at college, a number they arrive at based on surveys that even the conducting researchers admit are likely to be inflated by response bias. Actually reliable statistics from the Bureau of Justice put the figure at 6.1 per thousand for students and 7.6 per thousand for non-students. Still way too many, but not even close to the number President Obama has repeated in public. In 2015, 89% of colleges reported zero campus rapes. Now, I don't mention this in the book, but if you take an 89% rape-free figure and you put that next to 1 in 4 or even 1 in 6, you know, whichever statistic they wheel out this week, women getting sexually assaulted at campus. Well, the way averages work means that those last 11% of schools presumably have 100% rape rate in their undergraduate populations. Where are these schools? Which ones are they? And why aren't parents pulling their kids out of them? Something just doesn't add up. If you want a clear example of the power of fake news, consider what the rape culture narrative did to American college campuses. Miscarriages of justice up and down the country. Colleges facing crippling lawsuits from students. Male and female undergraduates terrified of one another. The former of being dragged through new kangaroo courts springing up on college campuses. The latter of a rape panic that paints college-aged men as insatiable psychopathic monsters. Virtually every media outlet insisted some variation of lad banter or frat culture was responsible for a new epidemic of rape. Video game developers found themselves also being accused of rape culture if they made their characters too sexy. Newsstands faced pressure to take raunchy magazines off shelves. Blurred Lines, an innocuous pop song by Robin Thicke, was portrayed across the media as a rape anthem, all because it contained the line, "I know you want it." The song was banned from multiple college campuses in Britain and even in America, and making it all worse, any criticism of feminist commentators was portrayed in the media as the result of misogyny. I find it hard to understand how everyone allowed themselves to be hoodwinked for so long by this idea of rape culture. Rape has existed since the first caveman saw a cavewoman with slightly less facial hair than the others and picked up a bone club. How do we get this idea, though, that it's a brand new crisis, worse than it's ever been? The crime statistics are inarguable. Rape has declined nearly 75% since just the early 1990s, and it continues to plummet everywhere. For some time now, feminists have preferred fiction and feelings to facts and reason. As discrimination against women has largely disappeared, feminists have had to invent new, fake problems in order to stay relevant and have something to be angry about. Campus rape culture is a myth, a particularly egregious and damaging example of feminist mythology. But it's hardly the only one. Younger listeners might be surprised to hear this, but being pro-life used to be a feminist position. The original feminists, like Mary Wollstonecraft and Susan B. Anthony, denounced abortion. Well, abortion is murder. Abortion is wrong. And I think everybody knows that, which is why abortion activists are so angry all the time. It's like when you catch someone in a lie and they get mad at you because they're embarrassed about getting caught out. It's the guilt, you see. When I say abortion is wrong, its defenders leap to their feet demanding to know why I want to jail a 10-year-old rape victim. Well, guess what? I don't want to jail that girl, and I defy you to find any opponent of abortion who does. The Catholic Church provides graceful reasoning on many things, and it provided reasoning on moral dilemmas long before the first feminist had a hissy fit. In principle, says the Catholic Church, the direct, intentional taking of innocent human life is wrong. Now, because that's a principle, it's easy to say that even in the most heartbreaking case, like that of the 10-year-old that we're considering, it cannot be right to take the innocent life growing inside her. But as Western civilization has always understood, hard cases make bad law. As St. Thomas Aquinas said, human laws do not forbid all vices from which the virtuous abstain, but only the more grievous vices from which it is possible for the majority to abstain. In other words, it's not wise to punish with human law everything that may be opposed to the natural law. Thomas Aquinas wasn't the killjoy Puritan your lying professors claim. St. Thomas and before him St. Augustine both followed anti-utopian views, for instance, when it came to prostitution. They thought it was wrong to do, but foolish to make illegal. I don't think they'd approve of hooking for haute couture, so my 20s still required some in-depth confessions, but the situation is a lot more complex and subtle than your teachers will tell you. The Aquinian distinction between human and divine law means that I can say it's wrong to take an innocent life without having to say that we should outlaw abortions in every single case. In a sane country, we would argue about which cases should be illegal. But just because I don't believe abortion ought to be outlawed in all cases doesn't mean I don't find it appalling. Feminist campaigners like the harpies behind the Shout Your Abortion hashtag, which is exactly what it sounds like, women boasting about killing their own children, want to turn the slaughter of innocents into a token of pride. And these women are the worst humanity has to offer. Even if abortion had no negative effects on the person who undertook it, it would still be wrong. But just in case you need more persuading that murdering children should be frowned upon, consider the effects on the mother. In 2010, the Canadian Journal of Psychiatry published a study based on a sample of 3,000 women in the United States. It found 59% increased risk for suicidal thoughts, 61% increased risk for mood disorders, and 261% increased risk for alcohol abuse. In a sense, the law doesn't have to punish those who get abortions. The guilt itself is a punishment. Removing any sense of guilt from having an abortion is not protecting the mother's feelings. It's actually making everything and everyone worse off. Abortion is obviously bad for the future women it murders too. Sex-selective abortion is becoming common in the UK and other countries, alongside a growing Muslim population, and it also has disastrous effects on the lives of the women that kill their own children. It doesn't surprise me that feminism promotes abortion, because feminism seems to always go against the actual interests and wishes of women. Abortion is particularly horrifying given the widespread availability of contraception. Given the ease with which women can now avoid becoming pregnant in the first place, having to have an abortion, outside unusual cases like rape, is the height of personal irresponsibility. Not that the widespread availability of contraception is necessarily a good thing, and I've got into a lot of trouble for saying so in the past, but I've said it before and I will say it again. Birth control makes women unattractive and crazy. I first articulated this in an article for Breitbart, and one of the most amusing days of my life was hearing Hillary Clinton read out this headline in her speech about the alt-right. Now, Hillary can whine all she wants, but my statement remains true, and there is copious evidence in my favour. Studies have shown that women using the birth control pill DMPA gain an average of 11 pounds over 3 to 4 years. Cellulite, also known as cottage cheese thighs, only emerged after the invention of the pill. Women who take the pill regularly won't receive the natural attractiveness boost that fertile women receive every month, and the pill even makes women more incestuous, that is to say, attracted to men that are genetically closer to them. While the ability to choose when they become pregnant was no doubt a source of great liberation and comfort for women, Western birth rates have plummeted in the decades following the mainstreaming of contraception. Comfort isn't always a good thing. And that goes for men too, by the way. Unexpected parenthood used to be an important test of a man's virtue. Would a man, suddenly a father, stick around and raise his child, or would he move on to the next girl? If women are wondering why men have suddenly become such assholes, it might be because there's now virtually no downside to hitting and quitting, and easy access to contraception shares a large part of the blame. Feminism's denial of facts isn't contained to recent panics like rape culture. Some feminist myths have been circulating for decades. Take the pay gap. It's considered an article of faith by business leaders and politicians alike, but it's a feminist lie that claims that women, on average, are only paid 79 cents for every dollar earned by a man. Study after study after study show that the wage gap shrinks to non-existence when relevant non-sexist factors like chosen career paths, chosen work hours, and chosen career discontinuity are taken into account. The key word is chosen. It's true there is a gap between the average pay of men and the average pay of women, but it's also true that 93% of workplace deaths were men in 2015. Most of the remaining 7% were probably lesbians. The wage gap is almost entirely explained by women's choices. Men prefer technical jobs and women prefer people-oriented professions. Now, when the debate reaches this stage, feminists will usually pivot and make one of two arguments. Either A, that women's jobs should be higher paying, or B, that the pernicious social influence of the patriarchy brainwashes women into staying away from high-paying fields like science, technology, engineering, and maths. But this is economic illiteracy of the most obvious kind. And the former argument, of course, also reveals the Marxist pedigree of third-wave feminism. The latter is a Gordian knot feminists can't unravel, and they're too proud to turn it over to a man for help. They say they want more women in STEM, but they also encourage women to sign up for worthless gender studies degrees. As Christina Hoff Summers puts it, want to close the wage gap? Well, change your major from feminist dance therapy to electrical engineering then. No feminist ever does. The feminist war on science doesn't end there. Possibly a greater intellectual travesty is what feminists have done to the study of gender difference, which ought to be one of the most rapidly expanding frontiers in our understanding of ourselves, but under the direction of feminists and left-wing universities has withered into mindless repetition of 1960s social science shibboleths. One of the reasons feminists fight so hard to stop big box retailers selling girl toys, which are dolls' houses, baby pushchairs and stuffed toys, and boys' toys, action figures, toy trucks and building sets, is because they fervently believe that these innocuous playthings socialize men and women into respective gender roles. They believe, or at least they say they believe, that if you make a girl play with a truck or a train set, she'll be more likely to grow up to be an engineer. Thanks to decades of pseudoscience from feminist academics and left-wing sociologists, this last argument can be tricky to unravel. But thankfully, some of our foremost psychologists, like Steven Pinker, David Buss, Robert Plomin, and Simon Baron Cohen, have spent most of their careers doing just that. The sum total of their research is overwhelming. Gender roles are largely governed by nature and not by nurture, as feminists would have you believe. The most compelling research comes from Baron Cohen, perhaps the world's leading autism researcher. Baron Cohen grew interested in gender roles after he noticed that boys were approximately 4 times more likely to be diagnosed with autism than girls. He knew autism was correlated with over-systematizing, or an over-technical brain, so he decided to test if boys really were, as the old sexists believed, born with more technically oriented brains than women. The linchpin of the feminist argument that women are made, not born, is the claim that girls are socialized into their female roles during their early childhood. In order to test this claim, Baron Cohen decided to run experiments on newborn babies before any socialization could have taken effect. He provided male and female babies with a physical mechanical object, like a mobile, and a social object, like a face. Lo and behold, the male babies showed greater interest in the mobile, while the female babies showed more interest in the face. Other studies also drive home the inescapable reality that men and women are simply wired differently. Surveys of women across countries have found that women in developing countries, where jobs and resources are scarce, are more likely to enter STEM fields. Yet in the vastly more feminist West, where women have greater financial security and completely open career choices, women choose different professions. In other words, when women have a choice, they don't choose physics and maths. That's not to say women don't find any scientific fields appealing. Psychology, which is people-oriented, and biology, which is plant, animal, and again, people-oriented, are both dominated by women, as is veterinary medicine. Whenever I meet a feminist who claims that the patriarchy prevents women from going into astrophysics and computer science, I always want to ask them, why doesn't it prevent them from going into biology, where 58% of bachelor's, master's and doctorate degrees are given to girls? Well, I've yet to hear a persuasive response, but if you believe there is a sexist conspiracy, a patriarchal conspiracy, to keep women out of physics and maths, you have to explain why there isn't one in biology and veterinary medicine. And there's more. Men and women respond differently to stress. Women prefer to be with people, while men prefer to be alone. Men and women also experience romantic jealousy differently. Men are more upset by sexual infidelity, while women are more upset by emotional infidelity. Gender differences can also be observed in entertainment. Men prefer realistic shooters and competitive video games, while women prefer social games like The Sims. Men consistently prefer action movies. Women consistently opt for rom-coms. No matter how hard the leftists of entertainment try to change things, men and women stubbornly continue to give money to products they actually like. Perhaps the most hilarious example of feminists' desperate attempts to preserve the fiction of socially constructed gender roles is their effort to exclude transgender people from the movement. Feminists would be totally fine with trannies if they didn't pose an existential threat to decades of gender pseudoscience. But you see, male-to-female trannies say they're women born in a man's body. The comparatively rarer female-to-male trannies say they are men born in a women's body. In both cases, they're affirming the idea that gender is something you're born with, not something that society imposes on us. You see, you can't have it both ways. You can't at once say that gender is a social construct and at the same time claim that some people are born with male brains into the wrong bodies. Feminists have to pick one. Worse, trannies tend to reaffirm gender roles in their behaviours. Male-to-female transsexuals will wear skirts and lipstick. They make their voices as stereotypically feminine as possible to pass as women. And female-to-male transsexuals, similarly, are obsessed with growing chest hair. You can see why some feminists are frustrated. After decades of trying to persuade women to burn their bras and shave their heads, along come a bunch of trannies with YouTube makeup tutorials and high-pitched girly accents. As Julie Bindle, a prominent feminist critic of transgenderism, says, it's precisely this idea that certain distinct behaviours are appropriate for males and females that underlies feminist criticism of the phenomenon of transgenderism. Well, feminists may be right, and trannies may simply be mentally ill, rather than born in the wrong gender, but it has nonetheless led to one of the longest-running feuds in feminism, the battle between so-called trans-exclusionary radical feminists, or TERFs, and the hipper pro-trans wing of feminism that you find on Twitter. The latter faction, which tends to skew younger and less academic, which is perhaps why they don't fully grasp the danger that the Born This Way concept poses to gender feminism, has had the upper hand in recent years, successfully banning anti-trans feminists like Bindle and even Jermaine Greer from university campuses. There is now overwhelming evidence against the out-of-date 1960s theory that gender is a social construct, but it continues to be repeated as received wisdom throughout the entire American media. Nothing is more amusing than watching the frustration of feminist parents as they come to terms with the reality of gender differences. Shannon Proudfoot, a writer for the left-leaning Canadian magazine Maclean's, lamented on social media that she could already see her daughter preferring pink. "I have no idea why," wailed Proudfoot. "We've worked so hard to avoid that." Joel Wood, an assistant professor at Thompson Rivers University, quickly replied with some emotional support. "Pink and Disney princesses," he said. "We tried to discourage them, but our daughters gravitated toward both." I find this anecdote both hilarious and uplifting. It's hilarious in the same way that watching a cartoon villain humiliated by a plucky hero is hilarious, and it's uplifting because no matter how hard leftists try, they simply can't beat human nature, and nobody can work out quite why they're trying to. Beyond their ignorance of the facts, modern feminists fail to understand the inherent value and beauty of gender roles. The masculine and feminine and the interplay between the two have been responsible for some of the greatest expressions of art and culture, from Wagner's Tristan and Isolde to Titanic. Could Shakespeare have written Romeo and Juliet without a healthy understanding of how men and women differ? Jane Austen didn't become one of the most renowned authors in the English language by having her characters dye their armpit hair and join a lesbian commune. No, her protagonists relished in their femininity, even as they struggled with it. Gender differences are part of the human experience. And in pursuit of this harebrained crusade to destroy gender roles, feminists want to control the lives of boys and girls in minute detail. Ordinary people recognise this for what it is, authoritarianism. If feminists want to regain credibility and perhaps tackle the issues that still matter to women, they will first have to come to terms with reality, and that starts with the biological basis for gender roles. More importantly, they're going to have to rediscover a commitment to free speech, and they've got to start showing up to debates again, armed with facts instead of feelings. I often face accusations that I'm too harsh toward feminists, and I can see why people say so. After all, I don't just critique feminist arguments, do I? I'd never miss a chance to draw attention to their looks. And let's face facts, some of them look fucking frightful. My old favourite Lena Dunham is a particular visual travesty, both being shockingly unattractive and determined to pose nude or semi-nude at every available opportunity. And doesn't she just love bitching about the people who give her a hard time? So as a thoughtful gentleman, I will comply, because there's nothing that she likes more than an opportunity to whinge. No one wants to see obese, hairy men with their tops off. So why does she assume that anyone wants to see her sprawling naked like a beached manatee? I just don't get it. Now look, luckily for all of us, the stress of President Trump is, according to Lena herself, getting her skinny. That's daddy always helping the helpless. Getting Lena Dunham thin. Is there anything he can't do? I will readily admit that my fixation on appearance is part of my faggy obsession with aesthetics. Like a true gay stereotype, I used to do a lot of interior design, and bad aesthetics offend me on a visceral level. I can't help but point them out in both men and women, and I often draw attention to the pallid complexions and thinning hairlines of my male opponents too. But enough about Ben Shapiro, we'll save him for later. If there wasn't a point to my appearance-focused one-liners, if they served no greater purpose, and if all they accomplished was just cruelty, I'd happily contain my impulses, but there's an important underlying point to all of this that most people overlook. It's so much fun! Okay, I'm kidding. It's this. Anyone who has paid close attention to the evolution of the left over the past few decades will have noticed that it's taken a decidedly therapeutic turn. This is the subject of books like Therapy Culture by Frank Furedi and One Nation Under Therapy by Christina Hoff Sommers, which chart the rising trend to treat feelings and emotions as things to be protected rather than challenged. On campuses, this instinct finds its expression in trigger warnings, demanded by social justice warriors to warn students in advance of content, whether it's lectures, books, films, or works of art, that might hurt or trigger them. At the University of Oxford, law students demanded trigger warnings before lectures on sexual assault law, on the grounds that the subject matter might be distressing. The thought that these law students should seek to toughen up on issues they might have to defend in open court apparently never occurred to them. The left's embrace of therapy culture has led damaged people to gravitate to the movement. And why wouldn't they? Instead of encouraging people to change themselves, the left tells vulnerable people that they should instead change the environment around them to protect themselves from having their feelings hurt. It's not your fault, the left soothingly coos, it's society. Obesity, a disorder that's as much mental as physical, gets the same treatment. More than a third of adults are obese in the United States, with nearly 70% classified as overweight in some way. And health problems caused by obesity are one of the biggest reasons for healthcare expenditure, with estimates of the annual cost ranging from $147 billion to $210 billion a year. Obese employees are also estimated to cost employers an extra $506 each per year. Being fat isn't just damaging to you, it hurts everyone else too. What does the left do in the face of this crisis? Well, Michelle Obama at least has campaigned for better diets and active lifestyles, even if the meals her campaign produces are disgusting and systematically thrown away by children. But the radical left, the intersectional feminist left, the left that dreams up new categories of oppression, has responded by declaring that the feelings of fat people are more important than the facts of their health. I encountered the results of this during my college tour at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. There, I was confronted with a morbidly obese girl who interrupted a joint event featuring me, radio host Stephen Crowder, and Christina Hoff Sommers. Her interruption consisted of loudly screaming, "Keep your hate speech off this campus," while flailing her meaty arms over her head. The video of this outburst instantly went viral online, and she became later known as Triggerlypuff. The internet would shortly discover that she gave presentations on fat acceptance and body positivity, two new concepts dreamed up by intersectional feminists. Their attitude is summed up in one dreadful slogan, "Healthy at every size." Well, the internet was quick to mock Triggerlypuff, but I wasn't, because she'd been sucked in by an ideology that promised her shelter from the hurtful realities of the world, where weight loss is a prerequisite of health, not to mention happiness and social acceptance. The left received an eager foot soldier who proselytized its ideology and shouted down those who challenged it, and in return, Triggerlypuff received the misleading assurance that she was normal and healthy, a paper-thin shield that inevitably collapsed as soon as she came into contact with the outside world. I couldn't mock Triggerlypuff, fat celebrities who set a disgusting example for millions despite having the finest personal trainers in the world on their doorsteps, sure, but not Triggerlypuff. You see, her entire predicament was and remains too horrible. There is something deeply and appallingly sociopathic about the instinct among the modern progressive left to prey on vulnerable, lonely young women and give them messages that are guaranteed to condemn them to a life of misery and solitude. When people ask why I hate the progressive left as much as I do, this is my answer. Because it ruins people's lives. It deliberately and sociopathically gives people hope while stripping from them the ability to make their lives meaningful and enjoyable. To avoid more Triggerlypuffs, we have to tear down trigger warnings. We have to get rid of safe spaces. We have to end fat positivity workshops and other constructions the left has created to entice vulnerable, hurting people to their cause. All these things serve to do is encourage people to blame others and to attack society for making them feel miserable, when in reality they will never be happy unless they fix whatever it is about them that triggers the rest of us and our gag reflexes. When I call a celebrity fat, I'm not doing it just to be cruel. I'm calling attention to an obvious fact that the left seeks to suppress, that being fat is not a good thing. The same is true of being ugly, which I realise people can't change, but it's another thing the intersectional left is trying to convert into a category of oppression, contrasting it with the privilege of being hot. If you can fix it, you should. And if you can't fix it, you can't blame society for beauty standards, which change over time, but only slightly. There are objective standards of beauty for men and for women, and fundamentally, substantially, these don't change. Attempting to overturn them completely, something the intersectional left promises is achievable, will only bring misery on the least fortunate people in society. Some feminists create a sort of cult of ugliness that treats both beauty and happiness as enemies. The novelist Flannery O'Connor skewered this brilliantly in her story Good Country People. There's a PhD protagonist who changes her name from Joy to Hulga because she can think of no uglier name. In her 30s, she's hulking, never married, and friendless. O'Connor describes her like this: constant outrage had obliterated every expression from her face, and her eyes had the look of someone who had achieved blindness by an act of will and who means to keep it. Am I rationalizing my gay urge to raise up the aesthetically pleasing and tear down its opposite? Yeah, maybe, but I'm not joking when I say fat shaming should be a social obligation. Daniel Callahan, President Emeritus of America's oldest bioethics research institute, agrees with me. Safe and slow incrementalism that strives never to stigmatize obesity has not and cannot do the necessary work, he says. The force of being shamed and beat upon socially was as persuasive for me to stop smoking as the threats to my health. With a little effort, we can help fat people help themselves, but first we have to make sure that fat acceptance, perhaps the most alarming, irresponsible, and cruel idea to come out of leftist victimhood and grievance politics, is given the heart attack it deserves. Strange though it may seem, perhaps even those who fat shame solely out of cruelty and solely out of spite might be doing some good, because the sooner fat people come face to face with the reality of human nature, the sooner they'll decide that they have to make a change before it's too late. And if they can't change, they will at least be able to develop a method of coping, one that actually works. One day, perhaps, the fat acceptance movement will realize that forcing others to accept you only ends in repressed feelings and misery for everyone. And perhaps that's the day they'll realize that Michelle Obama, dare I say it, was onto something. And before you say, what can I do about being ugly? Well, you know perfectly well, if you're a man, work out a lot, learn some jokes and get a good job. And if you're a woman, save up for surgery and stop fucking eating. In 2014, it would have been easy for me to answer the question, do we need feminism, with a resounding fuck no. Feminism in the West served little purpose other than hating men, making absurd demands, lying about inequality, and obsessing over trivial issues. It has poisoned relations between the sexes, destroyed due process on campus, and constantly saddles businesses with pointless gender diversity requirements based on bogus economics. But now, thanks to the mistakes of progressives, maybe we do need feminism in the West, or at least some parts of it, because whereas rape culture on college campuses is a figment of feminists' imagination, the rape culture brought to the West by Muslim migrants invading Europe by their millions through the courtesy of horrendously misguided European elites is very real indeed. So too is their culture of rape, wife-beating, honour-killing, female genital mutilation, and forced marriages. After spending years trying to make feminism relevant again with phony faux issues like gendered toys and Twitter harassment, progressive immigration policies have finally succeeded in establishing a rape culture, just not in the way they imagined. If feminism wants to recover its lost credibility, it needs to look overseas to the feminists of Muslim countries. If all feminists were like Ayaan Hirsi Ali, a survivor of female genital mutilation in Somalia, who is now one of the West's foremost critics of Islam and a champion of women in Muslim countries, feminism wouldn't be so unpopular. People might even admire it. Feminists can also look to the Kurdish women of the People's Protection Units in Syria, whose version of smashing the patriarchy is putting bullets in the chest of ISIS warriors. That's a feminism we could all get behind. But for now, feminists should resign themselves to pats on the back from Daily Beast columnists, total oblivion with regular people, and absolute hatred by lovers of free speech, facts, reason, and logic. I'm sure the feeling is mutual. In fact, I know it is. Feminists hate me for a myriad of reasons. When no one else was speaking up against them, I took on some of their leading champions during the Gamergate controversy, which we'll cover later in this book, and I exposed their bogus complaints of online harassment. I go on TV and I'll call them darling to their faces. They hate that. I promote facts over feelings. They hate that. I stick up for men when nobody else will, and they really hate that. And I resist, above all, the new trend for affirmative consent. Feminists aren't satisfied that the scales are already tilted in women's favour when an allegation of rape is made. They want complete control over romantic relationships. It's not enough that they can destroy a man's self-esteem with a word of rejection. They want to throw him in jail if his advance is too awkward. Third-wave feminists believe it's their duty to destroy any man's life who is accused of rape, no matter if it's a bogus claim or not, or if the truth is the lady said yes and then afterwards regretted it. That's the reason we now have affirmative consent, perhaps the most Kafkaesque set of laws in America, signed into statute for all colleges in California, Louisiana, and Indiana, and statewide in New York and Illinois. It's the idea that if you don't consent at every stage of a sexual encounter, you've been raped. That effectively means asking before every kiss and every boob squeeze. Now look, while I don't love feminism, I do love women, and it makes me sad to see what feminism has done to a generation of young American women who could have been and done anything had it not been for BuzzFeed and Gawker. Everywhere feminism exists, it is a threat to the happiness and freedom of women. Just think how funny Sarah Silverman used to be before she contracted feminism, cracking outrageous jokes about Jews, Mexicans, and gays. Now she's just another disapproving hypocrite on Twitter. Feminists have passed the point where they'll ever be popular, but if they focus on the real threats to women today, in particular from Islam, they might at least win back some measure of respect. But I gotta be honest, I'm not holding my breath. Chapter 5. Why Black Lives Matter Hates Me. I love black people. I love black people so much my Grindr profile once said no whites. Of course, I didn't write no whites because some people would find that offensive, but I used words that got the same effect. I think I said, don't contact me if you're under 7 inches or you know who your dad is. Anyway, some black people, the ones conned by the Black Lives Matter movement, don't love me as much as I love them. And after everything I've done for the black community, I've lost count of the number of black guys I've personally lifted out of poverty. Admittedly, I do send them home in an Uber the next day, but sometimes I get depressed just thinking about this subject. And I have to remind myself that Black Lives Matter is just a small vocal section of the black community, bankrolled by malicious, progressive white billionaires, and elevated by a disingenuous press. Really, Black Lives Matter should be thanking me. In August 2015, I published a story on Breitbart highlighting the extraordinary case of Sean King, who was then claiming leadership of the movement alongside Jonetta Elzy and DeRay Mackeson. King claims to be half black, born to a black father and a white mother, but a closer examination of King's family tree by blogger Vicky Pate revealed a shocking truth in King's birth certificate. It identified Jeffrey Wayne King, a white man, as Sean King's father. It also identified Sean King as ethnically white. That's right, a self-appointed leader of Black Lives Matter who attended a historically black college on an Oprah Winfrey scholarship targeted at disadvantaged black kids had, according to his birth certificate, two white parents. For more than 2 days after I reported on the questions about Sean King's background, King tried to ignore the issue, blocking people on social media who brought it up and refusing to answer media questions, despite massive international interest in the story. Finally, in an article for the left-wing blogging platform The Daily Kos, he delivered the only argument that had a chance of getting him out of the scandal, that his mother had an affair with a light-skinned black man, a man King refused to or could not name. The implication was clear. King had no idea who his father was, and had thus been making representations about his ancestry he couldn't justify. My response to King's claim that his mother had slept around was simple. Take a DNA test. If his claims were true, taking a DNA test and putting its results on the public record would have put the matter to rest once and for all. Needless to say, he still hasn't done so. As it turned out, these explosive racial allegations are just the latest in a string of controversies surrounding Sean King. On July 21st, the Daily Caller had reported that his account of a brutal, racially motivated beating in 1995, which at least two reports have described as Kentucky's first hate crime, did not match up with a police report from the case. King, 35, has related the story of the hate crime on his blogs and in his recent self-help book, wrote the Daily Caller's Chuck Ross, seemingly to bolster his credibility as an activist and a self-help guru. While King has said that he was attacked by up to a dozen racist and redneck students, said Ross, official records show that the altercation involved only one other student. Ross goes on, and while King has claimed that he suffered a brutal beating that left him clinging to life, the police report characterized King's injuries as minor. Left-wingers, especially on campus, are fond of faking hate crimes to boost their own public profiles and bolster support for their political causes. But King was doing far more than that. He was using his position as one of the unelected figureheads of the entire Black Lives Matter movement to drum up sympathy and, ultimately, to line his own pockets. In an America where victimhood is currency, it's highly profitable to be oppressed. King's story is mirrored by that of Rachel Dolezal, as she now calls herself Nkechi Amare Diallo, who built a career in the NAACP by pretending to be black. After she was exposed, Dolezal claimed that she identified as black. Months before this story broke, I joked that after transgender people, the next frontier of left-wing identity politics would be transracialism. I didn't expect to be proven right quite so soon. But unlike Sean King, Dolezal did not attempt to convince anyone that she was ethnically black. She might have succeeded had she done so, but she didn't, and as such, she attracted huge volumes of hatred for BLM in return for her honesty. I felt a little sorry for her more than anything. Her case is ridiculous, and I was happy to ridicule it, but it's also sad. It's sad, but maybe it's not surprising. After all, the left has made victimhood prestigious, profitable, and in some respects almost revered in culture. Even with all the legitimate problems faced by black people in America, it makes sense that some people would pretend to be members of the race to reap the attendant rewards. With all the benefits that come with victimhood, it's little wonder that so many wealthy and powerful people do so much to sustain the political edifice that supports it. The Black Lives Matter movement, indisputably the primary vehicle for black victimhood politics today, is a campaign propped up by hundreds of millions in donations and grants, including $33 million from progressive billionaire George Soros. The point of these donations is strictly to advance the cause of identity politics and racial division. It can often seem as though BLM isn't so much a black civil rights movement as an anti-white hate group. Black Lives Matter does nothing to serve the black community or black lives, and worse, it does extraordinary damage to both. There is a malicious, violent force in America that seems to kill only black people and ignore whites. Its presence can be felt in every city. In some areas, this threat means black people cannot walk down the streets without fear of being shot. This malevolent force is not the police. It is inner-city gangs, who are primarily black themselves. The numbers are indisputable, and yet just for sharing them with you, I'll be deemed a racist. Between 1980 and 2008, blacks made up 52.5% of homicide offenders, despite making up just 12.2% of the population. In the same survey, it was found that 93% of black homicide victims were killed by other black people. Black Lives Matter focuses exclusively on deaths caused by the police, yet these are far eclipsed by the black deaths caused by other black people. In 2014, there were 238 black deaths at the hands of police, a number sensationally reported by Raw Story as more black deaths than on 9/11. But in the same year, there were 6,095 black victims of homicide, more homicide victims than any other race, and double the 9/11 death toll for all races. And virtually all those black homicide victims died at the hands of other black people. The dramatic gap between deaths at the hands of police and deaths at the hands of other black people raises the question of why Black Lives Matter focuses its energies exclusively on the police and on so-called white racism. Like the men's health gap, the black murder gap is very real and simply isn't discussed by black activists. I suspect it's a matter of tribalism or in-group, out-group psychology, a common occurrence in politics. It's like feminists who blame their everyday grievances on an invisible patriarchal conspiracy, or Wi-Fi-enabled Waffen-SS wannabes who think Jews are responsible for all the bad things that happen to them. Or, I guess, Democrats who blame Russians for Hillary losing the election to Daddy. It's very easy to dodge responsibility if you have a bogeyman to lump the blame on. Leftism, which combines tribal identity politics with a disdain for personal responsibility, is the ultimate political expression of this destructive instinct to blame other people for your problems, instead of undergoing the difficult process of self-reflection. But Black Lives Matter isn't just ignoring the murder gap. They're making it worse. Whenever Black Lives Matter torches another usually black neighborhood, police are left with no option but to withdraw from proactive policing until tensions cool down. That means fewer patrols in black neighborhoods and fewer stop and searches of black people, which would save black lives. It can be almost impossible to reason against Black Lives Matter-inspired action, peaceful or otherwise, regardless of whether it makes sense or not, but let's try anyway. In 2015, after Black Lives Matter rioted in Baltimore, the city suffered its deadliest year in history, with 344 homicide deaths in 2015. Progressives at Raw Story were wringing their hands over 238 black deaths caused by police officers across the entire country just 1 year before. Baltimore's black deaths passed that number by 106 in just one American city. At first, the left vociferously denied that there was a spike in violent crime across America caused by rolling back proactive policing in response to Black Lives Matter. But those of us with common sense knew otherwise, and we called it the Ferguson effect. 10 heavily black cities saw a homicide surge of over 60%. Eventually, the evidence grew so compelling that even Vox admitted the problem was now too clear to ignore and grudgingly conceded that the Ferguson effect was, quote, narrowly correct, at least in some cities, end quote. Black Lives Matter claims that the police hurt black people. It's true. Police shootings do disproportionately affect black people. They make up 26% of police shooting victims, despite only being about 12 or 13% of the population. But as has been tirelessly pointed out by every conservative journalist who has the balls to cover this topic, black people are also vastly overrepresented in crime statistics. According to Bureau of Justice statistics, blacks were charged with 62% of all robberies, 57% of all murders, and 45% of all assaults in the 75 largest U.S. counties in 2009, even though they made up only 15% of the population in those counties. When paired with these crime statistics, it's no surprise blacks make up 26% of police shooting victims. It's almost a surprise they don't make up more. Moreover, it's not always white police officers doing the shooting, a fact that casts doubt on claims from Black Lives Matter activists and progressive journalists that there's an epidemic of white racism in America's police force. From the same article, quote, the Black Lives Matter movement claims that white officers are especially prone to shooting innocent blacks due to racial bias, but this too is a myth. A March 2015 Justice Department report on the Philadelphia Police Department found that black and Hispanic officers were much more likely than white officers to shoot blacks based on threat misperception. That is, the mistaken belief that a civilian is armed. A 2015 study by the University of Pennsylvania criminologist Greg Ridgway, formerly acting director of the National Institute of Justice, found that at a crime scene where gunfire is involved, black officers in the New York City Police Department were 3.3 times more likely to discharge their weapons than any other officers at the scene, end quote. On the rare occasions when police officers do shoot a black suspect, they're just as likely to do so if they, that is the officer, are black. Whenever black critics of the police have dared submit themselves to use of force simulations, which put participants in police scenarios where the use of force against a suspect is an available option, they end up pulling the trigger just as often as white policemen. There are white people that Black Lives Matter should look up to, but they're not Sean King. They're Heather McDonald, the tireless Manhattan Institute researcher who has outlined the damage done to black lives by the Black Lives Matter movement in meticulous detail, and many of the citations in this chapter, available in the print edition, are from McDonald's work. They're Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York, whose proactive policing caused gang violence in the city to plummet, saving countless black lives. Or Piper Kerman, author of Orange is the New Black, who used her experience in the U.S. penal system to create a national conversation about prison reform. And they're the hundreds of thousands of police officers of every color who patrol America's streets at night, preventing young black men from murdering each other and their neighbors. Black lives don't matter to Black Lives Matter, because if they did, Black Lives Matter wouldn't focus on police-related deaths, which make up a tiny part of preventable death. They would focus instead on the problems in their own communities, rather than the dwindling shimmer of white racism. Above all, they wouldn't force police off America's streets. The great truth obscured by the media and left-wing politicians is that the police are not the enemies of black lives. They are, in fact, their greatest defenders. Not even a proud dissident conservative like me would deny that there aren't real enduring issues in America that make it more difficult to be a black person. If I were a partisan hack, I might shy away from making that admission, but I won't. Unlike the largely bogus complaints of feminists and gays, who at this point are largely privileged and protected classes, some African Americans, and especially women, are still something like second-class citizens in America. Education is a prime example of this. Schools in America are still largely segregated. Black pupils overwhelmingly go to schools in lower-income neighborhoods, where class sizes are large, the standard of teaching is poor, and gangs prey upon adolescent boys, especially if they distinguish themselves academically. In 83 out of 97 large American cities, the majority of black students attended school where most of their classmates were low income. In 54 of those 97 cities, the majority number was over 80%. Fixing America's schools would go a long way to solving the deep-seated issues that caused black people to remain stuck in a cycle of crime and poverty. But unlike the angry tribal politics of Black Lives Matter, the political dividends of such reforms could only be reaped in the very long term. Efforts to fix America's weakest schools, as George W. Bush discovered when he attempted to do so, typically caused more political damage than support. The problem of black schools is part of a wider maelstrom of disadvantage faced by black people in America. Black children are more likely to live in inadequate housing, more likely to grow up in conditions of relative poverty, and more likely to have uneducated or poorly educated parents, which is one of the strongest indicators of future academic and professional success. You'll notice parents is plural in the previous sentence, but as most people know by now, 70% of black children are born to single women. Black fatherlessness is widespread and socially and educationally devastating for black children. Furthermore, black children are more likely to grow up surrounded by crime, which makes them more likely to fall into the lifestyle themselves and more likely to be affected by crime in the first place, which has a host of ramifications that affect educational attainment, including absenteeism and stress. And that's real stress, not the triggering that feminists experience when they encounter someone they disagree with. And it's those absent dads that make the difference, the fathers who aren't around to stop gang violence growing up in local neighborhoods. And then, of course, there's the war on drugs, which needlessly puts hundreds of thousands of black people in jail. Entire generations of young black men have been lost to the prison system. This must end. If Black Lives Matter's main purpose was instituting prison reform, I'd carry one of their signs myself. I don't claim to have the answers to all these problems, but I'm not going to pretend they don't exist. And Republicans need to take these issues seriously. Both Republicans and Democrats have treated black voters terribly for the last few decades. I'm no libertarian, but it's no surprise that Senator Rand Paul was polling so well with black voters before he dropped out of the Republican presidential race in 2016. Paul's proposals for drug reform, prison reform, and education reform were specifically designed to address issues in the black community. Discussing continued racial disadvantage in America is going to be frustrating for conservatives who are sick of constant, bogus complaints about racism. But there's no excuse for ignoring facts. The left responds to uncomfortable facts with hand-wringing and denial. It's time for grown-ups to take control. Disadvantage does still exist, and something has to be done about it. But the left is only making it worse, with ill-advised welfare programs that try to fix black poverty simply by throwing money at the problem. I know somewhere in this country there is a brilliant conservative mind that has just the right solution, but he's probably too fearful of being called a racist to bring it to the table. This book, I hope, will show him that you can't let idiots get in the way of progress, and you can't let feelings get in the way of facts. Black Lives Matter is instructive because it illustrates how the political and cultural establishment can spread misinformation even when the truth is in plain sight. Anyone can access the information needed to debunk the selective truths spread by Black Lives Matter, but it does take time and effort. Activists, cultural elites, and the mainstream media know that most people have too much going on in their lives to fact-check the narrative, especially if that narrative is blasted out of every TV network, broadsheet newspaper, and online social network, and if the consequences to questioning that narrative are allegations of racism. Take, for instance, the most popular slogan of Black Lives Matter: hands up, don't shoot. The genesis of this rallying cry came from the death of Michael Brown, a black man, at the hands of Darren Wilson, a white police officer. So what we're told about this sad event is that Brown was surrendering to Wilson with his hands in the air when Wilson needlessly, fatally shot him. The story came mostly from Brown's friend Dorian Johnson, who was with Brown at the time. The problem is multiple witnesses and all the evidence suggests that this is a lie. Brown didn't have his hands in the air. Johnson simply made it up. But his lie led to massive riots throughout the country. Incredulously, mainstream media continues to peddle the hands up, don't shoot lie. Johnson has never been punished in any way for this untruth, nor the riots he directly caused. And the narrative that Officer Wilson shot a man who had his hands up continues to this day. And the guy's life has been destroyed. There's perhaps one major mainstream newspaper, The Wall Street Journal, that regularly publishes articles critical of Black Lives Matter, but virtually every other publication is completely on board with the poisonous message that America's police officers, one of the most important groups out there defending black lives, somehow have it in for black people. Here's a selection of op-eds from mainstream outlets published in the past 2 years. Firstly, The Washington Post: Black Lives Matter and America's Long History of Resisting Civil Rights Protesters. the New York Times with Dear White America. You can just imagine what followed that. And the Chicago Tribune. I never have to worry I'll be shot in Chicago because I'm white. This article amazingly managed to talk about the problem of gang violence while simultaneously condemning allegedly overzealous policing. You know, if I was fed a constant stream of articles telling me that the world hated me because of the color of my skin, I might burn down a city or three too. But I don't read the white supremacists at the Daily Stormer, and I don't believe my race is under siege. Unfortunately, African Americans rarely hear anything else. I tried reading Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, a horribly dull book and open letter he wrote to his son. In it, Coates explained how he'd grown up in a bad neighborhood and had to be tough to survive. But he went on to lament over the fact that his son would grow up to be treated like he'd grown up in a hard neighborhood and had thus become tough. Between the World and Me won a National Book Award only because it was so unreadable, so everyone assumed that meant it was brilliant, but it wasn't. Progressives have such power to shape the narrative. They control the mainstream media, all the prestigious awards, Hollywood, the commanding heights of the new social media economy, and everything else you care to think of. If they were so motivated, they could use this power. They could create inexorable pressure to solve the real issues in America's black population. But instead, they're using it to push Black Lives Matter, one of the most destructive movements in America's history. And you know, it actually gets worse than that. Whenever you reveal truths about problems in the black community or call out the hypocrisy of the cherished BLM movement, as I have, charges of racism are not far behind. This is, of course, compounded by my great crime of giving a level-headed analysis of the alt-right, which has led media organization after media organization to brand me a white nationalist. Of course, afterwards, they always follow with a groveling apology and a public retraction after my lawyers get in touch, but by that time, the damage has already been done. The left in America is so stupid that they seem to genuinely believe that disagrees with Black Lives Matter is the same as hates black people and wants a white ethno-state. It doesn't occur to them that you can care about black people and at the same time object to the tactics and strategy of Black Lives Matter. Racism is the second most absurd of all the charges the left has foolishly used in their futile attempt to sink battleship Milo, and they throw this allegation at everyone. The truth is, the worst thing I've ever said to a black person is not tonight, baby, I have a headache. But the media doesn't care about that, because since I disagree with the tactics chosen by Black Lives Matter, I must, therefore, be a racist. In addition to the fact that I'm part Jewish and thus have no love for anyone who hates or discriminates against minority groups, have you seen the people I sleep with? My dating history looks like a Benetton catalogue, but that, of course, would require some honesty on the part of reporters who blithely and in some cases deliberately and knowingly write stories including the phrase white nationalist and white supremacist. The left's usual response is to resort to a cliche. They'll say, having black friends doesn't mean you aren't racist. The reason they use this argument so often is because it eliminates the best possible defense against charges of racism. My question to people who make this argument is as follows. If it doesn't satisfy you that I spend time with, make love to, and even for heaven's sake fall in love with black men when nothing is forcing me to, what would persuade you that I'm not a racist? I already know the answer. It's nothing. Many of the most cherished people in my life are black men, and because I love and respect them, I believe that they deserve the truth and not lies. In the face of the harsh reality of black America today, it's a reality that includes problems created and sustained by the left and by the black community itself, as well as real problems of enduring racism. The left, by contrast, seeks to patronize minorities by preventing them from coming into contact with anything that might offend them. There's also the riposte from race baiters that you can be a racist and still sleep with or fall in love with black men because all you're really doing is fetishizing black bodies. You'll be familiar with that phrase if you've spent any time on Twitter at all. This argument seems hysterically to boil down to the fact that some people don't like it, that everyone thinks they're hot. I've yet to hear a coherent argument that explains how I could get engaged to a black man and still be a racist, and I've also never met a black man who's offended by stereotypes about penis size. Leftists are convinced that my criticism of Black Lives Matter is motivated by racism. But real racists tend not to hide their motivations. They reveal them plainly in their language. Ask a white supremacist if he's a white supremacist, and you'll get the answer, yes, I'm a white supremacist. The Daily Stormer helpfully puts swastikas on its front page. The same cannot be said of counterparts in the Black Lives Matter movement, who couch their anti-white racism in the language of social justice and progressivism. Take Yusra Kogali, who's a leader and co-founder of BLM in Toronto, who described white skin as, quote, subhuman. She actually used the word subhumxn. It's spelled H-U-M-X-N, an alteration of the word man being a popular trend among intersectionalists. She claimed that white people are a, quote, genetic defect of blackness, end quote, and that melanin, the pigment that gives human skin its color, quote, directly communicates with cosmic energy, end quote. Because of this, Kogali proclaimed that black people were in fact superhuman. She spelt it superhumxn. You know what? You'd have to buy the hardback. I'm sorry. It seems that Black Lives Matter is happy to have open racial supremacists as leaders, provided their skin color is correct. Creative biology is nothing new to black supremacists and separatists, like the belief that a black scientist named Jacob created the white race as a race of devils. In the past, these could be laughed at and considered as loopy as flat earth theory. Now, believers in this stuff are lauded by mainstream politicians and commentators. That, by the way, wasn't the first time Kogali had made a racist comment on social media. In February 2016, she tweeted, "Please, Allah, give me the strength not to cuss, stroke, kill these men and white folks out here today. Please, please, please." We don't need to guess at Kogali's motivations. Her hatred is plain for everyone to see. Yet the mainstream media seems more interested in trying to explain how a sassy gay British columnist with Jewish heritage and a black boyfriend is the real racist. There are some in the progressive intersectional left who argue that racism against white people doesn't and cannot exist. For a time, the top result on Google for "Is it possible to be racist to a white person?" was an article from the Huffington Post arguing that such a thing was impossible because racism equals prejudice plus power, and whites, quote, control the system and economic structure in society, end quote. You know, I'm not sure this argument would be very convincing to the mentally disabled white kid who was kidnapped and tortured by four black people in Chicago. They livestreamed the ordeal on Facebook, gleefully hurling racial abuse at him, such as "fuck Donald Trump" and "fuck white people," slapping him and slicing his scalp with a knife. I'm also left to wonder if, under this new definition of racism, an immigrant cab driver in New York who doesn't pick up black guys is a racist. I'd like to see a BLM activist explain how a Pakistani immigrant has any power over a black American US citizen. It's a bit like walking into a carnival house of mirrors when definitions of words are changed in order to support a bogus argument. Are there black people who hate white people? Yeah. Are there black people who think whites are inferior to blacks and have no problem admitting it openly and publicly with no fear of reprieve? Yes. And are these same black people racists? Of course they are. When Lyndon B. Johnson discussed the need to tackle racism in America, he was under no illusions about the gravity of the problem facing the nation. Here's what he said, and these are Lyndon Johnson's words. "The Negro fought in the war. He's not going to keep taking the shit we're dishing out. We're in a race with time. If we don't act, we're going to have blood in the streets." It's been more than 50 years since Johnson signed the 1964 Civil Rights Act into law, and America has blood on its streets, but it can no longer be blamed on racism, or at least not on white racism. On July 7th, 2016, the black supremacist Mika Xavier Johnson opened fire on police officers in Dallas, Texas, killing five and injuring nine others, as well as two civilians. It was the deadliest incident for U.S. law enforcement since September 11th. Just 10 days later, another black supremacist, Gavin Eugene Long, opened fire on police officers in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He killed two officers and hospitalized another three, one of them critically. Both Johnson and Long grew up in a society in which university professors, celebrities, and mainstream news outlets told them that the police were racist and wanted to kill them. Both men turned to virulently racist forms of black nationalism, which, unlike, say, Pepe the Frog, received scant scrutiny or attention by media and political elites. In many university departments, the racist anti-white views held by Long and Johnson are virtually encouraged. While both men are individuals responsible for their own actions, it would be simplistic to argue they weren't also products of their culture, products of their environment, and products of the messages they were bombarded with since birth. While the progressive left harangues white twerkers and dreadlock wearers as racist, and while the establishment media wrings its hands over alt-right memes, black people in America are being fed a diet of hatred, of anti-white, anti-police garbage that inevitably sometimes spills over into violence. The greatest tragedy is that the primary target of this violence is the police, one of the greatest, largely unacknowledged allies of black communities. It's the police who stand between black people and the greatest threat to black lives, gang violence. It is the police who disperse black rioters when they're burning down black neighborhoods. And amazingly, cops will continue to do both, despite seeming to receive only contempt in return. When violence is committed against the police, it doesn't discriminate by ethnicity. The two NYPD officers who were shot execution style at the height of Black Lives Matter unrest were Asian and Hispanic. I'm proud to enjoy the support of police officers and other men and women serving America, and I'm never more humbled and grateful than when I receive praise from these people who risk and give so much for their country, often in return for nothing but scorn from the public and from politicians. And few things rustle my jimmies, but this persistent injustice is one of them. Black Lives Matter hates me, and I hate them. But I don't hate them because they pose a threat to white people. I hate them because they do precisely the opposite of what they claim to do. I hate them because they're hypocrites. I hate them because they cause more black lives to be lost, not less. And they do so by attacking the one group of people trying to help their communities. The people who really ought to hate Black Lives Matter the most are other black people. Chapter 6. Why the Media Hates Me. It was 2 weeks after the election of Donald J. Trump as President of the United States, that glorious day, and the Deputy Prime Minister of Japan, Taro Aso, was visibly annoyed. But he wasn't annoyed at Donald Trump. Speaking in Japan's National Diet, their parliament, the famously blunt Deputy Prime Minister shot down a suggestion that the country should begin to make plans for Trump's policies, as predicted by the American media. He said, "There's no point in Japan making policy based on the guesses of American newspapers when they are always wrong. We shall just have to wait until things are decided." Aso was right to be annoyed. What is a Japanese politician to do when previously trusted names in Western news, like the New York Times, the Washington Post, the BBC, and CNN, fail so comprehensively to describe what's going on in America?